Thanks. Good morning. Welcome to the Woodsfield Church of Christ. Glad that you're here, and welcome especially to our visitors, both in person and online. Glad that you could join us, and it's good to be together. Although I will say, I was away this week for a conference, and I was in Florida. I know, it was rough. I'm telling you, 85 degrees, palm trees, and I come back and 8 inches of snow on the ground. It's a weird thing to go between. And even today, I mean, let's be honest, you don't even have to go to Florida for that weird shift, right? I mean, this week, like if you just stick around for a few more days, it's going to be 70 degrees outside, which is just odd. So welcome to Ohio. I think the saying is, if you don't like the weather, just wait because it'll change. But we are going to be in Mark chapter 11 this morning. No PowerPoint, but the title of the lesson is A God for the Nations. If you're taking notes, if you want to follow along, that's the title. And we're going to be in Mark chapter 11 this morning. Mark chapter 11. And I'll have to be honest with you. This is one of those stories that I'm still scratching my head over. You know, as a preacher, you like to pretend like you know. And you think everybody expects you to know what's going on in the passage and all the little pieces of it and how they all work together or don't work together. And I'm just telling you right now at the outset, there's still some things about this that I just don't get. And we'll get to that in a minute. But for a second, I want to take you back to your elementary school days on the playground. You remember the playground? I mean, I'm assuming you had a playground or a parking lot to play in. I don't know, something to get outside at recess time. You played on the playground. And what was it like? Do you remember what it was like to be an elementary school kid on the playground? Just tell me, what was it like? Fun, okay. Freedom. Yeah, it's my daughter's favorite class is recess, right? Was it intimidating ever? Yeah, when the bullies came around. All right, somebody's being honest, right? And everybody that was saying, no, you were the bullies, all right? I know. I know. For most of us, if you kind of go back, if you can remember, elementary and middle school, you know, especially elementary school, that's a scary time, right? It's a scary time of life in some ways. You're trying to figure out who you are. You're trying to make friends. You're trying to figure out who your people are. And it's interesting, as you grow and as you become an adult, you look back on those years, you think about what it was like, and maybe even you have kids and you observe your kids or grandkids on the playground interacting with each other. And I'll just challenge you to do this sometime, maybe at the playground or somewhere else where there's a bunch of kids running around playing. How do they act? How do they interact? What do they do? Doesn't take long for them to start forming groups, right? To figure out who their people are. To start playing with this kid or this boy, this girl over here. And maybe to the exclusion of this boy and this girl over here. Sometimes it's a painful thing to watch, right? Because kids can be cruel, can't they? Kids can be mean. I mean, they'll just flat out tell the kid, I don't want to play with you. You ever see a kid do that? Like straight up in the face. Like as adults, we're a little bit nicer about it. We still do that, but we're a little bit nicer. We just don't say it to their face. We just kind of, you know, body language in other ways. We're just not interested in the conversation. But kids, man, they'll just tell you straight up, I don't want to play with you. And then the kid goes off, the other child goes off crying to mom or the teacher, bawling, you know. Why are we like that? As human beings, why do we exclude certain people and include others? You ever watched and wondered why that is? Maybe you think about your own actions and why it is that you prefer certain people over another, but the reality is that we all do it in different ways and at different places in life. We all exclude and include. And the story overall is a story, I think, about exclusion and inclusion. Why is that? Well, we'll get started and talk about it in just a moment. But I think the ultimate thrust of what Jesus is getting at is he's angry and he's frustrated at a group of people who have been excluding others that were never meant to be excluded. So Jesus is, within the last week of his life, we already talked about that last week as we dealt with the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Palm Sunday, sometimes we celebrate or express it like that. the last week that he would be alive, just a few days, he would be nailed to a cross. And so Jesus is still in Jerusalem. He's still talking and walking around in the midst of the city. And he has this interesting interaction with a fig tree. Now, this is where I don't understand it, okay? So he's walking up to this fig tree. If you were listening to the reading that Davey gave earlier, Jesus is walking along. He sees this fig tree. He's hungry, and he wants some figs. And he goes up, and there's no figs on the tree. And he curses it. He says, "May no one ever eat from you again." Does this story not confuse you? Because if you're paying attention to some of the details, it says, Mark says specifically that it was not the season for figs. So it's like, okay, Jesus, you're expecting something that isn't going to happen, right? Because it's like walking up at this point, it's like walking out to your yard where your apple tree is and expecting there to be an apple hanging there and then getting angry and cursing at it because there's no apples. It's like, well, of course there's no apples. It's March. And it's snow on the ground. This would have been about the Passover season, so April-ish. Figs didn't usually appear until June. And so Jesus is a couple months out from figs, and he walks up to this fig tree. There's no figs, duh. And he gets angry at it and curses it. And at the end of the story, they walk back by the fig tree, and it's dead. And it's tempting, it maybe at some point in this story, to look at Jesus as some maladjusted, like, angry person with a temper, and he just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like using the magician that just kind of does whatever he wants. Die, tree, and it dies. Because he's angry. He wanted a fig tree, and it didn't give him figs. So there's that side of it. There's a tendency that we have, and we read this story, we say, well, there wasn't a season for figs. Why is Jesus cursing a fig tree and expecting something that was never going to happen out of the fig tree? But that's exactly it. The fact that Jesus is angry at a fig tree when it never was going to give him figs anyway indicates that the fig tree is really an illustration of a deeper problem. And I'll just go ahead and tell you, I was going to separate these stories, the story of the fig tree and the story of the temple, because at face value, they seem to be two very different stories and not really connected at all. But that's because we often misunderstand the illustration of the fig tree and don't tie it in with the story of the temple cleansing. So Jesus continues on from his cursing of the fig tree and he moves into the temple. And this is more well known to us, right? We're familiar with the story of the temple cleansing where Jesus kind of gets angry and he walks through the temple and he chases the money changers out and turns the temples. Other gospel accounts record Jesus is making a whip and driving them out of the area. And he calls them out for several things. And most of the time as we read this story, as we read Jesus cleansing the temple, we're tempted to look at this story and think that Jesus was mad for people doing business in the temple. And while that may be part of it, again, I think that really misrepresents what Jesus is really angry about. Take a look at chapter 11 real quickly with me and look at what Jesus says in the midst of him being angry and pushing the people out of the temple. He says, "My house, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." So we hear thieves, we think robbers, we think they're extorting money. That's got to be the solution. That's not really it. Jesus is here quoting two passages from the Old Testament, one in Isaiah, one in Jeremiah. Look at these passages with me as we try to understand Jesus' intent here a little bit more. Read Isaiah with me, chapter 56. Put your finger in Mark chapter 11, flip back to the Old Testament for a second, and go with me to Isaiah chapter 56. Have to give me a second to flip to. Isaiah 56. I'm going to read 6 and 7. It says, "Among the smooth stones of the valley is your portion. They are your lot. To them you have poured out a drink offering. You have brought a grain offering. Shall I relent for these things? Or I'm sorry, that's chapter 57. I'm thinking, this doesn't make sense. This isn't what I remembered. And you're looking at me like, what is he doing? Chapter 56, one page over. Verse 6, and the foreigners. This makes, yes, okay. I was wondering. Anyway. And the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, everyone who keeps the Sabbath and does not profane it and holds fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. That's what Jesus says. It is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations. The problem was that it wasn't. At least in Jesus' day, it wasn't a house of prayer for all nations. There were different courts in the temple that separated people according to gender, according to ethnicity, according to different subsets and divisions to keep people who were less than holy out of the temple. And there was a court called the Court of the Gentiles. It was this massive area where the Gentiles were allowed to gather, but it was the outermost ring. It wasn't the innermost parts of the temple. And so the subliminal message, the implied message to people, was that you had to be a Jew, you had to be pure, you had to be a certain gender to be in with God. And then there's these Old Testament passages about the temple supposed to be this place of gathering for all peoples, that God would be worshipped here by everyone, that there would be foreigners here, that it wouldn't just be Jewish people. It was so much, so strictly enforced in Jesus' day, this court of the Gentiles, that there were literally signs posted, warning signs around the court of the Gentiles, between them and the next place, the next court, that if they crossed over further into the temple sanctuary, that they would be, that they would not, no one would be held responsible for their death. In Acts chapter 21, we find actually that Paul encounters this same threat, because he's accused in Jerusalem of taking a Gentile into the inner courts of the temple, and the people riot because they so believe that these Gentiles shouldn't be allowed into the temple. And the Roman soldiers, if you remember the story, the Roman soldiers have to literally pull Paul out of the crowd because they were about to kill him. There is a distinct line of separation of people. That the Jews said, you stay over there. You don't come in here. And then there's this odd reference from Jesus to this den of robbers. My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. Look at Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7, just one book over in the Old Testament. I'll read a little bit longer of a section here to give us the context. I'm going to start in verse 8, Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 8, and work my way to 15. How can you say, chapter 7, verse 8, behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing all these abominations? In other words, the people have acted in totally ungodly ways, and then they come before the Lord in the temple and say, save us, Lord, we're delivered. We're here, we're in your temple. Verse 11, has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. Go now to my place that was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first. The temple used to be in Shiloh. Before it was in Jerusalem, there was another place called Shiloh where the people worshipped. So he says, go to that place. Go to where my name was before. And see what I did to it because of the evil of my people Israel. And now, because you have done all these things, declares the Lord, and when I spoke to you persistently, you did not listen, and when I called you, you did not answer. Therefore, I will do to the house what is that is called by my name, and in which you trust, and to the place that I gave to you and to your fathers, as I did to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight as I cast out all of your kinsmen, all the offspring of Ephraim. The people had become deceived in their thinking. They had begun to trust in a building rather than the one who created the building. They had become used to seeing this temple, and it was symbolic of God's presence with his people. In fact, even as far back in Jeremiah, this starts to happen. Jeremiah, at the beginning of the chapter that we just read, says, don't listen to these words when people say, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. They had begun to see the temple as a sort of security blanket that affirmed God's presence with them. And God says, oh, no. I destroyed the temple in Shiloh. I will destroy this temple too if you continue to act in this way. And Jeremiah, after he dies, that's exactly what happens. In 586, the Babylonians come and totally wipe the city clean and destroy the temple. And Jesus stands in a similar place. He says, you've forgotten what this was supposed to be about. You've made it a den of robbers. You've stolen from people what was supposed to be theirs. You've stolen the presence of God from the world, and you've made it a house of prayer for yourselves. And you set up dividing markers in your midst and separated and excluded different people that God has always wanted to bring to himself. And in essence, Jesus says the very same thing that Jeremiah says in another place. He says, there will not be one stone left on another. You see all these buildings, Matthew 24, he's talking to his disciples. He's looking at the temple when he's talking about it, and he says, you see all these buildings? There will come a time where not one stone will be left on another. And in just a few decades, the Romans would come in AD 70 and scrape all of the buildings off of the Temple Mount and push them over the edge. You go to the Temple Mount today, and you can still see at the bottom of the temple, over the edge of the mount where the temple was, all the stones that the Romans pushed off from the temple itself. Because it was never about the temple. Jesus came to show the people that God wanted to be present in their midst and in their hearts. And he gets angry and frustrated at the people of Israel who didn't get it, who had become fruitless and ineffective. So that brings us back to our story of the fig tree. The fig tree is a symbol of the fruitlessness and the ineffectiveness of the people of Israel. When there should have been fruit, or when there wasn't fruit on the tree, God curses it. And it has little to do in our minds as we think, well, there shouldn't have been fruit on the tree anyway, so why are you cursing it? Jesus uses the fruit and the absence of it and the fig tree itself as a symbol of the people who had lost their fruit and had become ineffective because they had separated out the nations from themselves when God had welcomed the nations to himself. And the next day, as we talked about already, they pass by the fig tree again, and the disciples are impressed that this fig tree that Jesus cursed is gone. It's all withered up. It's dried up. It's gone. And Jesus assures them, have faith in God. And he goes on to talk about this mountain. And a lot of people believe that what Jesus is actually talking about, if you believe that this mountain could be thrown into the sea and destroyed, that it will happen, that he's actually talking about the mountain of Jerusalem, the mount on which the temple was built. That he's not simply talking about any mountain that you might say be moved into the sea, that he's talking about a particular one in Jerusalem. And as I said before, this temple that Jesus was in would not last. In just a few short decades, it would be completely destroyed. And have faith here is likely an encouragement from Jesus to have faith in the midst of all of the symbols of religion being messed up and not what they should be. So what's this mean for us? As I said before, I'm not claiming absolute authority on this passage. There's still some parts of it that I'm not quite sure about, but I think the main idea of this passage is exactly what I just said, that Jesus is angry and frustrated at a group of people who have shoved others out. That it wasn't so much about money changing and being setting up business in the temple as it was that they had pushed people to the margins of society, that they had set up places of priority for themselves and made themselves more important than what God had intended them to be. And so the question I ask for us, as I think about our own place in this passage, is, do you have a faith that includes others, or does it select a few? Do you have a faith that includes others, or does it select a few? When somebody new comes into our building, how do you treat them? Do you welcome them? No matter the way they look, smell, dress, act, talk like? Or is there a subconscious thing that goes through your head? Well, they're not like me. They don't act like me. They don't look like me. They don't sound like me. I'll let somebody else deal with that. And you just kind of push them aside. As much as we would hate to admit the fact that we do this, we do. We stereotype. Right? We push to the side. We don't welcome as much as we should. We have hierarchies in our head of who is most important and who's lesser important. And ultimately what God says is that's not what I designed this to be like. The family of God should be for all. That it doesn't matter what you look like, smell like, act like, talk like. When you come in this building, when you come to be a part of the people of God, you are a part of the family of God. And it shouldn't matter where you came from or what you did, what people know about you. Here's the other thing. We often, in our small town, we know too much. You know too much. Chances are pretty good if somebody walked in there tomorrow, or next week, I guess, from off the street of Woodsfield, there'd be a few folks in here who'd know them. And not just know them, but know their dirt too. Know all the stuff about them. And so our challenge is not only do we look at someone and not really make a connection because they look like us, act like us, talk like us, not like us, but we know their dirt and we often put them in a category of, well, I know what they are doing. I know who they are. I remember what they were like in high school, even though it's been 20 years ago. I know who they really are. And we categorize people in our head and we shove them off to the side. And Jesus says, my house, figuratively, okay, this isn't a temple. There's nothing sacred about the church building. But my people, my house, the people of God, will become a house of prayer for all nations. Jesus says in John chapter 12, 32, he says, when I am lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. Does this church body accept everyone that comes through those doors? Or does it play favorites depending on social or economic status? Or what you remembered about their high school career? Folks, if we don't welcome everyone, we've got a problem. If we have problems in our heads of different places that people fall into, different categories that put them closer or further away from God, we are doing the exact same thing that the people of Israel did generations ago. And we are no better and no different than the children that we remember on the playground. And so again, I ask you the question, do you have a faith that includes others? Where does it select a few? We're going to sing a song here of invitation in just a moment. And we'll invite you to come and respond if you need to respond to the message itself. Or if maybe today's the day that you decide to be a follower of Jesus. You want to be a disciple of God. And we can show you and talk to you about that. And we'd love to talk with you in any way that we can in bringing you closer to God this morning. So please come and stand as we sing if you need to respond.